at 3:50, and today's date is March 9th, 2005.
We didn't adjourn at 3:50.
Did I say adjourn? Convene. I wish. Freudian slip. Convene. Thank you, Representatives Lynn and Cott and Guttenberg. Okay, so we have members present, Representative Lynn, Crawford, Cott, Guttenberg, and myself, Chairman Anderson. We do have a quorum. Excuse members of Representatives Roekberg and Ledoux. We have HB 171, overtime wages for flight crews. Representative Kelly's legislative aide, Heath Hilliard, is here. He will bring that up before the committee and briefly testify. We'll have public hearing and then have a vote to move that out of committee, which I'd like to do today. And then we will have House Bill 180, a brief presentation by Governor Murkowski on workers' compensation. And after that, we will adjourn. So, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I think I just saw several of you not too long ago. For the record, my name is Heath Hilliard, and I'm staff to Representative Mike Kelly. I'm here to present to you today HB 171. I will be very brief. I also understand that there are a number of people in the audience who wish to testify in this bill, and I certainly don't want to take anything away from their testimony. Very briefly, HB 171 clarifies legislative intent by retroactively removing flight crews from the scope of statutory overtime compensation required under the Alaska Wage and Hour Act, and that Wage and Hour Act is found in AS 2310-060. The retroactivity in this bill will apply to work performed on or after January 1, 2000. Just to give you a little bit of background, for quite some time, Department of Labor has had an uncodified policy to apply this overtime compensation exemption, but as a result of several class action lawsuits since 2000, there was less clarity with respect to that application. So in the 23rd Alaska legislature, we passed SB 54, which essentially codified that formal that informal policy by Department of Labor. However, we realized that we needed to offer greater clarification, so as a result, we have sponsored HB 171, which is a companion to a Senate bill. So with that briefly, I really just would be happy to take any questions from the committee. I possess not a great working knowledge of the issue, and that's why I would prefer to defer, to members in the audience.
Okay, any questions at this time? Seeing, hearing none, thank you, Mr. Hilliard. We'll next go to Tom Daniel. And just for edification of our records, I notice a lot of folks from Haglin Aviation are on board. I presume the owners, and I presume employees and council in front of me. So if you could please state your support or opposition to the legislation, that would be appreciated. And secondly, because we have limited time, please don't duplicate your testimony. So if you are a member, let's say in opposition to this, and you're going to repeat what your former or your fellow employee is stating, please don't do that, and please keep it brief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and I will try to shorten my comments, although they may be longer than some of the others. My name is Tom Daniel. I'm a partner with the law firm of Perkins Coie in Anchorage, Alaska, where my practice is devoted almost exclusively to labor and employment law. I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 171, which would make retroactive the law which the legislature passed in 2003, making pilots exempt from overtime. I currently represent Haglin Aviation in a class action lawsuit on behalf of pilots who are claiming overtime. This lawsuit goes on because the legislation which was passed in 2003 was not made retroactive, and so there are claims being made for the time period before 2003 when an explicit exemption for pilots was passed. To give you just a little bit of background, since at least 1949, pilots have been exempt from overtime under federal law, the Fair Labor Standards Act. And under Alaska law, there was no explicit exemption, but in the 1980s, the Attorney General of Alaska issued an opinion stating that pilots of air carriers in Alaska, for the most part, were exempt from overtime. And based on that opinion, the Alaska Department of Labor in 1986 sent a letter to the Alaska Air Carriers Association stating basically that air carriers in Alaska who carried passengers or hauled mail were exempt from the overtime requirements of state law. So for almost 20 years now, air carriers in Alaska have operated on the assumption under both federal and state law that they did not have to pay pilots overtime. Despite that fact, in the late 1990s, a few plaintiff's lawyers started seeing a possible way to sue in court. And as some of you may know, a court does not necessarily have to follow Department of Labor policy or an attorney general's opinion. And so there are currently at least three lawsuits pending against small air carriers in Alaska claiming overtime for flight crews. Because of that problem, in 2003, the legislature passed an explicit exemption for pilots of air carriers to basically enact into the statute what had been the Department of Labor's policy for almost 20 years. Unfortunately, when the legislature passed that law, that it did not include an explicit retroactivity provision. And therefore, in our case, for example, the judge has ruled that the law bars overtime claims after July 2003, but not for the time period before July 2003. So what this bill does is it makes it explicit that the law was intended to be retroactive, and it would apply to lawsuits that were filed prior to 2003. To tell you just a little bit about the lawsuit against Hägglunds Aviation, first of all, I would mention that it was initiated by a single pilot who had lost his job at Hägglunds and filed a complaint alleging age discrimination, not a violation of the Wage and Hour Act. When the Alaska Human Rights Commission investigated his complaint and dismissed it, he then found a lawyer who basically, I think, told him that he didn't have much of a age discrimination claim, but he might have an overtime claim. And that's how this lawsuit got initiated, even though that same pilot in his deposition testified that he felt that he was fairly paid. In the Hägglunds class action, it's brought on behalf of all present and former pilots of Hägglunds Aviation, which was a total of about 82 people. Out of those 82 people, 60 have affirmatively chosen not to participate in the lawsuit. So 72% of the people who could be in this lawsuit have said, we don't want anything to do with it. Of the 60 current pilots of Hägglunds, only one has chosen to participate in it. So even the pilots themselves, or at least the majority of them, have not supported this lawsuit. The purpose of this lawsuit is to ensure that the intent of the legislature in 2003 is effective not only in the future, but to lawsuits existing now. If I could switch gears just for a moment and tell you why this is important for a company like Hägglunds Aviation. Hägglunds Aviation is a true success story. Mike Hägglunds came to Alaska in 1972 to be a pilot. He flew for two small carriers, and then in 1981 he bought his own airplane and started Hägglunds Aviation Services, which at that time provided charter service in Mountain Village, Alaska. He lived in Mountain Village from 1976 to 1990, where he flew hundreds of medevac flights to the hospital in Bethel, day and night, all kinds of weather. He gradually bought more airplanes, combined with two other gentlemen, and by 2004, Hägglunds Aviation has bases in Aniak, Bethel, St. Mary's, Unalakleet, Nome, Kotzebue, Barrow, with scheduled flights to over 70 villages. Today, he employs over 180 people, including about 60 pilots. This lawsuit, this class action lawsuit, threatens the economic viability of Hägglunds Aviation. When Hägglunds started, and it threatens the economic viability of Hägglunds, despite the fact that Hägglunds is one of the best local carriers in the business, pays its pilots very well. In fact, in this case, one of the reasons that Hägglunds got sued was because he pays his pilots on a daily rate, a method of payment which, as will be explained by other witnesses, is to the benefit of the pilots and for the benefit of safety. They get paid even if they can't fly in bad weather or because of mechanical reasons. yet it's that very pay system that was challenged in this lawsuit. The end result of this lawsuit and the lawsuits like it is that a good corporate citizen like Haglund Aviation that has paid its pilots fairly and provides an essential service in Bush, Alaska, could face bankruptcy because what is, in my view, a technical violation of a law that was never intended to apply to pilots. And therefore, it's good public policy to pass this retroactivity legislation, and I urge you to support it.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Daniel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, Mr. Daniels, can you tell us why the date January 1st, 2000 was inserted into the...
I think it's a fairly arbitrary date, thinking that the statute of limitations on these types of claims is 2 years. It would be perfectly fine to me, out of an abundance of caution, to move the date back even further. You know, maybe to January 1, 1999 or 98. I think it's was selected because it should cover any claims that could be pending at the present time.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I remember working on this bill last year, and I remember that there was a lot of concern about we thought this might go back and change a court case retroactively. We were assured that by voting for the bill that it wouldn't go back and change the court case retroactively, that it was a prospective bill, that it would work on clarifying it from that day forward, but that it wouldn't go back and change the court case. I think it's pretty bad public policy myself to interfere with court cases, the laws that were in force at the time. I don't know about how far this has been taken in the appeals process. Never looked into that. I don't know if you've gone to the end of your process or not. I just know that myself, I got reassurance last year that we were not affecting the court case as it stood by voting for the bill, and that's the reason why I voted for it. That was the assurance that I needed to give the affirmative vote.
And I wasn't involved in that legislation. I wasn't here, so I certainly wasn't the one that gave that assurance, and I was actually, until you said that, I wasn't aware that assurance was given. In fact, it was my understanding, based on some of the legislative history that I've read, that the intent at that time was to make it retroactive, even though there wasn't an explicit statement to that effect.
Well, but, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I just wanted to put it on the record that there were a number of us that was our understanding at the time, that we were not affecting that case, and it wasn't a mistake. It wasn't just an oversight. At least not on my part.
Mr. Chairman, could I respond? And if I could just say, Representative Crawford, it seems to me that the law should be retroactive because the air carriers have operated based on a policy of the Department of Labor that's been in existence for 20 years, and it really is unfair for them to be assuming all this time that they don't have to be paying overtime to their pilots, and then all of a sudden in the late 90s and early part of this decade, they're being sued by pilots for overtime, when all this time they've been told by the agency of state government that's responsible for enforcing this law that they don't have to pay overtime. I don't see the fairness in that. And so all this retroactivity does is to clarify that it was the intent of the legislature that the law not apply to them. It shouldn't have applied to them in 2003 when the legislation passed. It shouldn't have applied to them at any time prior to that. That had always been the department's policy.
Okay, Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This was a very difficult question for me. It was a difficult vote. I understand that the Department of Labor had come up with their interpretation. The courts came up with another interpretation. Generally speaking, I don't think it's a good idea for the legislature to go back and change what the courts have done. Like I said, I don't know what part of the appeals process that you're in, but I generally have faith in the courts. I mean, we have to have faith in the courts rendering a good decision. I know that there's always a winner and a loser in a disputed question like this. So I know not everybody's going to be happy with what the courts do, but generally speaking, I think we have to depend on our court system.
Okay, we need to have questions asked to the testifiers, but thank you, Representative Crawford. Any other questions for Mr. Daniel? Seeing none, we'll go next to Mike Haglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll try to make it brief. This is not so much a question of a lawsuit against or a lawsuit for the pilots. We've only had one pilot that sued us, and the lawyers sued us on behalf of 80-some other pilots, of which 74% opted out the first 60 days. They brought one witness against us, or one testimony, and he and the plaintiff also both said they were paid fairly. They said they enjoyed working for Haglund's, and the reason they came to work for us is our work schedule, 15 days on and 15 days off. And they didn't have anybody, and after this last testimony, the guy also opted out. So they have, the original plaintiff is the only one that has come forward and says, yes, I want to be part of this lawsuit. I think I was paid unfairly. So it's not about the pilots. It's about the lawyers. They're the ones that stand to gain gain from that. And, of course, Mr. Daniel's firm and Mr. Richmond's firm also gain from it because we keep paying them. And that's going to go on until this case is done until we go broke paying them. And I won't take up any more of your time. I thank you.
And just one quick question, Mr. Haglund. So, and your testimony is also, isn't it, that it's about consistency? Post-2003, it's not overtime. Pre-2003, it is. That's not consistent in terms of public policy.
They're being paid the same. Everybody's paying their pilots the same as they were pre-2003. That you know, they were paying them before the same, and it hasn't changed anything. It's just, it's a good way to pay them. The pilots are happy. You know, they're safe pilots. You can keep good pilots up here because of the time off and because of the good working conditions.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? No. Thank you very much. Mike Burke. And then next up, Bruce McClassen, then Richard Clark.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mike Burke. I'm the general manager of Alaska Central Express. We're a all-cargo carrier based in Anchorage, Alaska. We serve about 35 destinations throughout Alaska. I'll try to be as brief as possible. We are in support of House Bill 171. We have been sued by a former pilot in July of 2004. As you're aware, the state exemption passed in July of 2003. We had an attorney that represented the pilot that saw a loophole where the statute of limitations goes back 2 years, so there's a period of July 2002 to July 2003 where this pilot is trying to seek a windfall off of this state exemption policy that was passed in 2003. So I urge the committee to support this bill. I don't think that when this legislative body passed the state exemption policy in 2003, it meant that it opened the window 2 years for pilots and attorneys seeking a windfall. So if you will, I please ask for your support.
Thanks, Mike. Any questions, Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Burke. If you had known the overtime provision was in place, would you have been able to schedule your pilots so that there was no overtime and still have the same number of pilots and accommodate your schedule?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, if we had known that the overtime was in effect, if it applied to the pilots, we would have altered our pay scale so that it's commensurate to what we pay the pilots today. So the overtime would have been taken in consideration to the same levels that we're paying, the levels that we have been paying our pilots over the last 20 years.
So in the end, they would have gotten paid the same thing.
Exactly.
Questions? Thanks.
Thank you.
Bruce McClassen. After Bruce, like I noted, Richard Clark, and then Ignatius Beans, and then Gray Mitchell. Oh, for questions. So Ignatius next, and then Karen Casanovas. Go ahead, Bruce.
Mr. Chairman, committee. My name is Bruce McClassen. I'm the president and owner of Grant Aviation. I am the president and owner of Grant Aviation. We employ about 120 people, 44 of which are pilots, primarily operating in West Alaska. I am here today. I've watched this case with great interest for two reasons. One, I pay my pilots the same way that Mr. Hagelin does. It's a daily rate, and we move to that rate in the interest of safety and of fairness because we believe it's the best way for the pilots and the company to be compensated. It removes the economic incentive for them to fly in unsafe conditions. They know they get paid by the day, whether they fly or not, whether it's not a factor. Also, and I must admit this, if Mr. Hagelin's suit is carried to its ultimate end and he is bankrupted by it, which I believe he would be were it successful in court, I would gain tremendously. He is my most direct competitor, and I would gain all of his business if he went out of business. But I am here because I do not believe that's right. He was operating under the guidelines of the Department of Labor and under federal law, as were we. We believe that we compensated our pilots fairly. The pilots agreed. And I'm just here because I don't believe that's right. We have not been sued yet. And because this bill was not retroactive initially, we are still open to suit. At any time there, a disgruntled pilot could be approached by an attorney or approach an attorney, and they could convert my entire pilot staff of present and former pilots into a class, and it would bankrupt me. So even though I had operated in good faith and negotiated in good faith with my pilots and paid them well, I guess that's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bruce, any questions?
None.
Thank you. Okay, next, Richard Clark. And just for everyone, everyone's stuck within 2 minutes. If you could please keep it within 2 minutes, that would be great. Your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm a pilot for Hagelin Aviation. Worked for them since February of 1996. They've been fair, honest, and generous at all times with me. I opted out of the lawsuit because I thought it was unfair. And if you have any questions for me, I'll be happy to try to answer them.
And so you're content with the salary base rather than the overtime and the way they
always
have it
been
structured?
They've always been fair.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Clark? See none. Thank you. Thanks for coming to testify and waiting. Ignatius Beans.
Cameron Nelson, members of the committee. I wholeheartedly support, I urge that you you look favorably upon the House Bill 171. If I can, I'll give you a little details on my history. I was born and raised in Mountain Village, Alaska, a place where MICA started. I'm a retired military officer, served 23 years. I've flown commercially in Western Alaska for 10 years. I've also managed. And currently I'm employed as a safety check pilot for Hagelin Aviation. I've known Mike for 25 years or plus. He's fair. He's honest, and he's upfront with his customers. Seeing that I'm from the region, I want to give back to the region. So I've opted to fly in Western Alaska. And Mike's been really fair with pay. You know, I've had opportunity to take jobs with the majors, but I declined so I could go back and fly in the bush where I'm from. When I heard about a lawsuit, I was really discouraged. That's bogus. And I think it's just bogus. So I urge you to look very upon the Senate House Bill 171. Any questions?
Thank you. You're in my, you live in my district.
I do.
From the Senate neighborhood. Good. Any questions for Mr. Beans?
We talked about your Army, Air Force, Navy, Marine.
I was an Army Guard.
Army Guard.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
For your support or testimony. Okay, next, Karen Casanovas. And then Mark Johnson, Michael Charlie, and Abe Armstrong. Karen? Oh, she's on teleconference, okay.
Karen Casanovas with the Alaska Air Carriers Association. I'm the executive director, and I would like to provide a few comments for you on behalf of the association, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. The Alaska Air Carriers Association represents more than 67 carriers operating in Alaska and over 75 aviation businesses which support them. Our association represents companies upon which the failure of this legislation would have a direct and profound impact. Moreover, the Alaska Air Carriers Association fully supports the positions of the Hagelin Aviation Companies, Cape Smyth, Alaska Central Express, and Grant Aviation. Without the passage of this legislation, economic burdens at several tiers will be imposed on carriers that perform passenger and cargo handling that are certainly so critical to the viable transportation needs of Alaskans around the state. The federal aviation regulations regulate passenger and cargo carriers and require them to take serious responsibility for the work that they perform. And this includes supporting safety, managing their companies in an ethical manner, and certainly taking care of their employees. The lawsuits filed against our member airlines failed to reach this threshold. Ruling not in favor of these carriers who have lawsuits filed against them would impose significant new costs on companies outside the purview of the original position of the Department of Labor submitted in 1986. And I just wanted to touch on that briefly and talk just a little bit about the background and then the cost. Carriers in our association are on-demand carriers, and they have repetitive trips over specific routes carrying cargo, mail, certainly passengers, and are contract carriers for the oil companies, for UPS, FedEx, and DHL, Airborne, and the like. We do have the letter, as Mr. Daniel previously stated, 1986, which advised the Alaska Air Carriers Association that the Department of Labor had adopted the position of the federal law and that pilots that flew interstate or hauled the mail were exempt from these overtime laws, and so they have been abiding by that since that time. To address the cost a little bit, these suits, again, could financially put many of our membership out of business. And what happens is these claims are not typically covered by insurance. So what happens, unlike the lower 48 states, where in Alaska the overwhelming issue for the Alaskan air carriers is the cost of insurance, without that being able to provide for in any way, and certainly where carriers often in Alaska can't even buy the insurance that they need and they can't purchase it at any price, something like this where they would need to absorb the cost from the lawsuits, these carriers would further financially be strapped. Again, many of our carriers operate all around the state, and unlike the lower 48 states, you know, it is a way of transportation. That is how they provide services for all of us to travel in and out of the state. Recap our position. The Department of Labor advised the Air Carriers Association that they had adopted this federal law. The pilots that flew interstate were exempt from those overtime laws. And again, moreover, these class action lawsuits could put many of our carriers out of business. A needed resource for all of us in Alaska, and therefore the Alaska Air Carriers Association overwhelmingly supports House Bill 171, and we please urge you to pass it. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. And just for the record, the music while you testified made your testimony even more compelling. Just kidding. Okay, any questions for Karen?
Star Wars.
Yeah, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Just a point. I'd like to just make a reference that the bill packet doesn't include the Department of Labor nor the AG's opinion.
Okay. Mark Johnson.
Yes, my name is Mark Johnson, and I'd like to contribute a little bit on a slightly different perspective from what I've heard so far. Hägglund Aviation is probably the best job I've ever had, and the pay at Hägglunds is more than fair. I came in May of 1980 to fly for Andreski, which became Herman's Air and was later Mark Air Express. And with the exception of 2 years in Emonic, I've worked, which I worked for Bruce there at Grand Aviation. I came back up to St. Mary's and worked from 1991, December of 91, until present with Hägglund Aviation. 25 years in the area. In the early 80s, we were paid by the flight hour only at my first job.
Jerry.
And I've seen both sides of the scale there. It can be a very dangerous way to pay pilots when they fly many hours and don't make a destination too frequently. Companies tend to go towards, if the load is not delivered, then there's no pay. So pilots can spend hours trying to get places they really have no hope of getting into in the hopes of making pay. The fairest, most safe way to pay pilots, in my opinion, is the way Mike Hägglund and Jim Tweedle are paying us. It's more than fair. And I believe the issue isn't so much, as I understand it, that this court case going on with Hägglunds and the potential court cases that can come out of it as to the retroactiveness of this legislation. When I first heard somebody was being sued for overtime, I was flabbergasted because I quite frankly don't see how pilots can work half a year, half each month, 15 days a month, be paid a full annual salary for it, and claim some kind of overtime. So if any of you have questions from my perspective, I'd be glad to answer them.
No questions for Mr. Johnson? Nope. Thank you, Mark, for your testimony. Okay, I'm gonna do something here. Normally, procedurally, we go through each testifier. There's a pattern here, which is a pattern of everybody's calling in or testifying in support of the legislation. We still have Mike Charlie from Hägglund. We still have Abe Armstrong from Hägglund. We have Grant Thompson from Cape Smythe. And we have Tom Nicholas from Cape Smythe. Are any of the four participants of this teleconference opposed to the legislation? Your silence will mean you support it. Okay, so I don't hear anyone in opposition from those four. Is there anyone that wishes to testify that is opposed to this legislation? Okay, because Representative Cott has to depart in 5 minutes, I'm asking that that we close public testimony unless there is something that any of the four members have that is not duplicative to what we've already heard. Does anyone want to speak? I'm happy to give you the time. I don't want to rush any of you, but if you're just duplicating, we appreciate it. But now we've heard 9 people. So is there anyone that wishes to add anything briefly?
Just briefly.
Okay, who's this?
This is Michael Charlie.
Okay, go ahead. You stated your name and who you're with for the record, and then briefly your testimony.
Michael Charlie from Tunic. I'm a pilot for Hägglunds. Just to say that if this lawsuit were to pass, just to think of all the lives that would hurt, not only the pilots, mechanics, managers, you know, rampers or ticket agents, but the whole economy. And in conclusion, I plan to fly for Hägglunds for the next 25 years if they're still operating. That's how comfortable I am with this company, with the schedule, with the salary, and the fellow workers that I employ. And it's obvious for so many who opted out feel the exact same way about Hagelin's, and I'm calling today to support House Bill 171. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Michael, for calling in. And I presume by the silence that the Grant, Tom, and Abe also feel the same way and are supportive. So with that, and I've offered by teleconference and in public here, anyone else wishing to testify? I don't see anyone else, so I will close the public hearing part of the committee meeting. And House Bill 171 is now before us. And is there any amendment that the committee wishes to offer? I don't see any at this time. If I could have a motion then to move the committee out of...
Mr. Chairman, I certainly appreciate this legislation coming forward. I think it's important for the state of Alaska and certainly to the small carriers that are going to be affected potentially. I think it's somewhat disingenuous. They've operated under good faith and effort under the Department of Labor, and I've generally been on board with the Department of Labor over the years. I think they have abided by that ruling of the Wage and Hour Act. In addition to that, I think it's unfortunate that we're here today. We should have had, in our wisdom, a couple of years ago when this bill originally passed, to address those potential lawsuits, and none of us would be here, and everybody would be much happier. So with that, Mr. Chairman, this does have some judicial impact, and it may be your wisdom, to, since we both sit on that committee, to have this particular aspect looked at in the Judiciary Committee.
Okay, so your motion is to move the bill out of committee. I'll object to note that I will, as chairman of Labor and Commerce, recommend that it be referred to Judiciary and stricken from being referred to the Finance Committee because it has judicial implications rather than financial implications to the state per se, and I will make that agreement to committee members who might have had concern passing it out with that legal analysis, and I will send that correspondence to Speaker Harris after, you know, this week. And so with that comment, I remove my objection. Is there any other objection to remove or to moving the committee out? Okay.
Just to state that I'm in agreement with Representative Kahn. This is very appropriate to be heard in Judiciary.
Okay. With that being said, the bill moves out of committee. Thank you all for your attention and everyone for waiting to testify. Sorry that we started late. And I will send that correspondence to the Speaker and request that he send it to Judiciary, and I believe the Chair of Judiciary agrees. Okay, next we have the presentation by the Governor's Office for House Bill 180, and that will be hopefully maintained to 30 minutes, and we appreciate your brevity. We'll have more time to analyze the bill, but today we just want the presentation. I see the placards there. Adjust accordingly, and I can, whoever is going to make the presentation, do you need me to make an at ease, or can you get set up? Okay, so we'll take a brief at ease. And we have the Honorable Commissioner Clary here to present the workers' comp bill by Governor Murkowski, House Bill 180. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Greg O'Clary. I am the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And I realize you're on a time constraint, and many of you are trying to catch aircraft out of town, so I will be very brief. I have some visuals I'd like to present. Actually, they're in your packet, Mr. Chairman. But Paula, would you just put the big pie chart up? Mr. Chairman, the bill you have before you is a composite of some very hard work done by members of the Ad Hoc Committee on Workers' Comp, the Workers' Compensation Division staff, and various other constituencies in the state. The reason the, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, I know you have to say, Chairman, Vice Chairman Lynn. The pie chart you see over your shoulder, Representative Crawford, is the picture of the 2003 cost of the workers' comp system at $223 million. Last year's bills that were before you really concentrated on doing some readjustment to the adjudicatory system, that is the hearing and appeal system, and it really only dealt with about $11 million in cost, or what turned out to be about 4.9% of the pie. In testimony received last year, those that opposed the bill testified at great length and challenged the department and the administration as to why we were not examining medical costs, which in this case shows that $115.2 million of the total for the year 2003 at 52% of the problem. According to information we received from NCCI within the last 3 or 4 days, the actual size of the medical cost piece of the pie will be pegged for 2004 at 61% and change. I think we rounded that up yesterday in another hearing in the other body at 62, but so the piece is getting larger. Therefore, the bill you have before you, and I won't go into detail on the sectional because the two experts, both Paul F. Lasanke, the director of workers' comp, and Madam Insurance, the insurance czarina, I believe that one of your colleagues called her, Director Hall from the Division of Insurance, will go into those details. But I think it begs the question as to why the governor chose to depart from the ad hoc two-year plan and go to a comprehensive bill this year, and I want to address that briefly, if I may. When we received the product, and by the way, the ad hoc committee, which is a volunteer citizens committee that has worked on workers' comp issues for many, many years, were asked by me, invited to go back to the table and begin work. It's my understanding they had not convened to deal with workers' comp since sometime in 1995. In fact, I have a piece of correspondence here dated February 23rd or 25th. I have put my glasses on, Mr. Chairman.
I understand that.
As you know, it's when you're aging, you're, I don't know which is first to go, but February 23rd of 1995, we received a copy of a correspondence to the Honorable Eldon Mulder, who was then sitting in the State House, that detailed some changes that they had worked on in the Workers' Compensation Act. And I'll go back to this in a minute, but that's the last time, to my knowledge, that the ad hoc or the Alaska Labor Management Ad Hoc Committee on Workers' Compensation actually had convened and dealt with any workers' comp issues. When we introduced our bill last year, they had not convened during that period of time either. They did convene as a result, I believe, of my contacting them on behalf of the administration and asking them to sit down and start dealing with the workers' comp issues, that some of which we laid before them last year in the two bills that we introduced. Anyway, getting back to the pie, why is it important for the administration to have a bill this year? And I think the short answer is that we're in a situation where if we are allowed to go beyond this legislative session, that the rate increases in premiums that employers will be looking at next year will force more small businesses to close their doors and put more workers on the street on unemployment. And that is a situation that we feel in the administration is near crisis, in terms of, especially for those workers who are going to lose their jobs and for those employers who won't be able to do business. Now, of the 16,000 active businesses that are reported by Department of Labor, and we classify active in a different sense than most folks, we call active employers, employers that contribute on a regular basis, unemployment insurance, tax, and other benefits that are recorded throughout our system. Of those businesses, I would venture to say, I don't know of one that wasn't impacted adversely by workers' comp rates over the last 5 years. Now, Paula, would you put up the one of the graphs?
Commissioner?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
If I could, just going back to the point you made earlier, that ad hoc committee you said had not met since somewhere in the neighborhood of 1995, but then they met again during the interim this time.
Yes, sir.
To work on it. And you made it seem like you made a great point, they not having met since 1995. but how does that tie into their meeting during the interim this time? Is there a problem that they've been out of session, apparently?
Well, I only raise that as an issue because I think the testimony you received last year was why wasn't the administration using the tried and true system of the ad hoc labor management committee. And I guess my problem with that and my response is, where have they been since 1995 when this problem was continuing to loom? Now, I'm not trying to be critical, you understand. I'm just trying to set the record straight.
Well, I just wanted to understand it better.
All right.
And but they did meet this time, is that correct?
They did, and frankly, I was pleased because I asked them to, and they put a lot of time in examining issues that need to be dealt with as well. But
and they wanted to meet also, did they not?
Pardon me?
They wanted to meet also. You ask, and they gladly...
They did, because I think they recognized the problem we were running into in terms of the workers' comp insurance rates.
So it's kind of by mutual agreement.
Oh, certainly. And because they are an autonomous group, and because the department and the division did not wish to set an agenda for them that they were unwilling to deal with, we were there as observers and in the presence or the personage of the workers' compensation director, Mr. Paul F. Lasanke, and one of our hearing officer staff persons, and provided them as much information as was available to us to help them in their deliberations. And they worked very hard, I might say, and we certainly were pleased with the progress they made to a point.
Thank you.
When we received the product, they had apparently made a decision fairly early in the process that they would not deal with any issues that either the labor side or the management side raised or took issue with that may have been may or may not have been controversial with respect to their discussions. The main issue that they decided not to deal with was the medical cost piece. Now, I'm going to read you from the letter that I quoted. I want this on the record, and I'll give you through staff copies of this letter. This is the February 23, 1995 letter. This is the last paragraph of the letter. We would, and this is a quote, we would also like to point out that there are more issues involving workers' compensation that we will be addressing in the future. This is underlined by some whomever. These include group self-insurance, medical cost containment, in parentheses, the medical cost portion of workers' compensation payments in Alaska have more than doubled between 1988 and 1992, comma, from approximately $20 million to an excess of $50 million, closed paren. Review of presumption of compensability and review of benefits, including health insurance. These issues will take further research and a great deal of discussion with various groups, but they must be dealt with to ensure that Alaska's workers' compensation system adequately protects injured workers while maintaining an equitable program for employers. And they concluded by saying, we thank you for your patience in allowing the ad hoc committee to prepare our agreement, and we look forward to your continued support in the future. Sincerely yours, William Van Hemmert, CRW Engineering Group for Management, Kevin Doherty, District Council of Laborers for Labor. The reason I bring that to your attention is because if the committee had not actually convened since 1995, we either didn't have a problem in workers' comp during that period of time, or there was no motivation or interest in doing so. And I'm pleased that they have reconvened and they are working diligently on the problem. But when we received the product of their work, the governor was not pleased with the result, not because they didn't work hard at it, but because it didn't meet his goal of trying to arrest the escalating rates by the premium year beginning January 1 of 2007. At that point, I called a meeting of the ad hoc committee co-chairs in Juneau to discuss the decision that the governor had made and informed them of such and, in fact, invited them to participate in the drafting process over the weekend. It was at that point in time, and I recall it was the week before we actually rolled out the bill, we had not drafted a bill, Mr. Chairman. There was no drafted bill from the administration at that point.
Mr. Chairman, to clarify, when did you start drafting the governor's bill?
We met with the ad hoc committee, I believe it was a week ago Monday. I'm looking at Mr. Lasanke. I don't, you know, my memory being involved, is that it was a week before we introduced our bill. So we rolled our bill out on a Wednesday or a Thursday, I believe, and this discussion took place the Monday before that week. So there had been, in fact, at the last meeting of the ad hoc committee that Mr. Lasanki attended, the ad hoc committee, and that occurred on a Friday, which I believe...
What month are we talking about?
This last month, February.
February.
When the ad hoc committee began discussing strategy about their bill or a bill from that group, they respectfully asked Mr. Lasanki to withdraw from the room, which he did. So at that point, we have had no direct contact or been involved with the ad hoc committee in terms of their meeting. We were told yesterday in testimony given by Mr. Doherty that they plan on meeting Friday, and it invited us to attend.
So as I understand it, the governor drafted his workers' comp bill in February. So the bill is, how long did it take from the time you started working on the governor's bill to the time it was introduced?
Well, we started working on, I believe it was Sunday morning that weekend. Here's the date, sir, Mr. Chairman. We began, no, we actually work started. Yes, it was a Sunday before President's Day holiday, and we worked through the night into the next day, which was a state holiday for everyone else. I believe we had an actual bill completed that we actually presented first to the advocates representing the various interest groups, and I believe that was on the Wednesday following.
Yes.
And then we had the press conference on the Wednesday following, February 21st.
So approximately how many working days was that for the governor to present his bill or to prepare his bill?
Well, state employee working days at 7.5 hours a day, probably six.
Six.
Within a 2.5 day period.
Okay.
Because we worked around the clock.
So approximately six business days.
Approximately.
Okay, yeah. And then how many days did the ad hoc committee work on their bill? Do you have any idea?
Oh, I think their testimony yesterday was...
I probably asked the ad hoc committee.
Yeah, I honestly don't know, but I know they spent a lot of time on it. But we remember they had given us the results of their particular, the fruits of their labor, so to speak, and we used a major portion of that information to fold in our bill. But we had also been running on a dual track. I had consultants on the payroll hired to meet with the bar, both the defense bar and the claimants bar, to try to find out from them what pieces of the comp system could be that they could jointly stipulate that needed to be fixed, and ask them for input as to what should be done. We had also met with members of the underwriters community, the three major underwriters in the state, during the interim to discuss some of their concerns about the comp bill. So all that information gathering, in addition to our experience we learned from last year's introduction of the two bills, to formulate the basis for the governor's legislation.
Thank you.
Now, let me just point to this particular chart for you. This is a premium rate for the Central Peninsula General Hospital, just to illustrate what has happened over the last 5 years. As you can see, that their premium rate for that particular health facility was under $400,000 in 2001. In 2005, it's nearly $1 million. That would get my attention, I guess, if I was using that particular health care facility for my children and for myself, because obviously their charge-out rates had to go up as well during that period. But that's workers' compensation. And the statute requires that employers provide that particular insurance. There's another chart there, Paula, on Copy Express, which is a small business, which actually nearly doubled their particular premium rate between 2002 and 2005. It went from $5,900 to $10,232. Now, this is a business of less than 25 people on the payroll at that time. And the last chart, which is McGraw's Custom Construction, which is a small especially a general contractor operating out of Sitka, that in 2002, their premiums were $146,950, nearly $147,000, and have now jumped in 2004, which is the last period we rated them, $314,110. And then I think we have a chart from the municipality of Kodiak.
And we'll be having copies of these charts.
They're in your packet, Mr. Vice Chairman. This is the rates shown for the Kodiak Island Borough, which is local government in Representative Ledoux's district, where rates went from $43,000 down to $24,000 in 2002, and now in 2005, $95,234. This particular local government has placed their new hire employees on a maximum 30-hour work week, which we are told denies them access to health insurance and pension benefits because they cannot afford to meet these costs, rising costs in workers' comp. Now, that's just the illustration. In your packet also, I think, is a press copy of a story that appeared in the Anchorage Daily News early in February that detailed the closure of the downtown Lamex restaurant. And there's a quote in there from the owner, woman that's been in business in that particular location for as long as I can recall. I think many of us may have had eaten there in the past, that her workers' comp increased about $60,000 over a two-year period. And we can do the math on how many tacos she would have had to sell to stay even with the board. But the point is that she laid workers off and closed the doors of that restaurant. And I would like in a moment to withdraw from my remarks and actually invite Director Hall to speak to you. She's online from Anchorage, and she has some comments I think she needs to share with you as to what she's hearing from employers. And then when she's finished, I'll wrap up, Mr. Chairman, because I know you're on a time constraint.
Well, yeah, and then are we going to go into the rollback of medical costs charges?
Yeah, we can if you like.
Before you leave today?
Yes, we can if you like.
Maybe just briefly touch on it before we leave.
Yes, I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
So if I beg your indulgence, if we could have Director Hall speak to her situation, if she's on.
How did you describe her earlier? I like that what you said.
I have to be careful. It's a good thing she's long distance. If she was here, she'd probably poke me with a hat pin or something.
Okay.
I think it was one of your colleagues that called her the insurance czarina.
Oh, I thought you said you okay. Shifting the blame here.
Be careful how you talk about me.
We're safe. You're in Anchorage.
I am sorry. I am in Anchorage, and you can tell what I sound like. I'm not coming through very clearly.
There going to be a workers' comp claim on that, is there?
If flying an airplane counts.
Okay.
I think it's contagious in airplanes. I appreciate the time, and I will try to be very brief. I do have several comments I would make that I will hold for a later date about the rate increases. I think all of you have heard me discuss this. In last year rates, this year's rate increases, particularly when I did my division overview for your committee early in the session. The only thing I will speak to today as the commissioner requests are the calls I've begun to get from employers. Last year when our average rate increase was 21%, I got angry calls. Who approved these rates? And people were angry and had less than complimentary things to say, and I understand that. And we talked about that. We talked about why. Had some very good conversations with employers around the state. As time progressed, I began to get calls from employers telling me they were at the verge of having to cut health insurance. They could no longer afford to provide both health insurance and workers' compensation for their employees. The calls we've been getting since the first of the year, when we had an additional average 12% rate increase with 49 classifications having increases in excess of 30%, are now I'm having to evaluate whether I can stay in business. I talk to consumers on a regular basis who are really looking at their costs and overhead as small businesses trying to determine if they can stay in business. They're concerned, they're depressed. These are wrenching calls for me to deal with. I have nothing much left to say to an employer who's, you know, on the verge of closing his doors because he can't stay in business anymore. I need something to say to them, and I'd like to be able to hold up a light at the end of the tunnel that we are looking at making some changes that will help us stop the dramatic increases we've seen in insurance rates. And I will stop with that, Mr. Chairman, and I will be happy to be there in the future when this bill is heard again and make other comments.
Thank you very much, Director Hall. I think many of us could actually stipulate that we need to get workers' compensation under control. The issue is not so much do we not need to get it under control, but the issue may be how do we fix it, and what's the best vehicle for fixing workers' comp.
Thank you, Representative Lynn.
Mr. Vice Chair, if I might then continue just briefly. You had requested that I respond to the portion of the bill that deals with the rollback of the reimbursement rates for medical. And I'll take just a few minutes if you'd like, sir.
Fine.
Under section, it's on page 18 of the bill.
Where's that? What page again?
Page 18, line 30. Actually, it's section 23 of the bill, but it starts on line 29, page 18. It goes then through page 19 and on to page 20. Briefly, just let me describe for you the rationale behind the fee reimbursement fee rollback to the December 1999, which in fact was the 2000 actual reimbursement rate schedule. Did you bring one of those books that I asked you to? We do the
pound. It got left in your
okay. House. The medical reimbursement schedule that the division uses to pay claims for various procedures, both all healthcare procedures, whether it be surgical, whether it be pharmaceutical, whether it be hospital care, is published in a rather large, about this thick, about 300 pages in this large book. And it details the rate of reimbursement that is paid out. And let me kind of give an example. This chart is a comparison of maximum allowable rates for various medical procedures. And if you can follow that, we'll have a handout, Mr. Chairman, for the committee members.
Okay.
It's in the packet? Okay. This is blown up because their commissioner has a tough time reading small print. This is the 2005 rates for Idaho, Oregon, Alaska workers' comp, Alaska workers' comp 2004, Alaska workers' comp 2000, Alaska workers' comp 2005. On the far left, if I might, over here. In Oregon, this is what they pay for this procedure, arthroscopy. That was in 2005, they pay almost just under $1,500. That's what their reimbursement rate is on the workers' comp in Oregon. In Idaho, it's $3,500. In Alaska, it was in the 2000 schedule, which is the one we rolled back to, even though we used the December 15, 1999 date in the bill, was $3,200. So it was pretty much in line with Idaho and twice as much as Oregon pays in 2005.
May I ask, what is the difference between almost half in Oregon as compared to the other states? Why?
Because they're using, in Oregon, I believe they're using a Medicare plus multiplier reimbursement rate schedule, which is what we had looked at initially in our bill and opted not to do that because I think that we received some feedback from the medical community that they weren't enamored with anything that had to do with Medicaid or Medicare, whether it was a multiplier applied or not. They didn't care for it. But we had to somehow identify the problem to the extent that I think the medical community would realize that we were not only serious, but we have to start working together to come to a solution on this. The 2004 rate for that same procedure was $3,800, and the 2005 rate is $4,100. This kind of gives you some idea of the increases in Alaska workers' compensation charges and reimbursement rates between 2000 and 2005. 27% increase in our system.
And how does that compare to the annual inflation rate between 2002, 2004, and 2005?
I cannot answer that question for you, Mr. Chairman, at this point, but we'll note that and respond in writing to you. Over, out here to the back injuries, the scans for lumbar without contrast, see the different numbers here. They're pretty much in line for Idaho and Oregon. And Alaska was still kind of tracking with Idaho's rate, but then increasing dramatically over Oregon's for 2004-2005. So the difference in the Alaska workers' comp charges between 2000 and 2005 was 47.2% for that particular procedure. So again, these are just small views of individual procedures. The one in, that I used in my press release, that is knee surgery, had a dramatic over 105% increase.
I think I need every one of those procedures.
I probably would do, but I probably shouldn't get them in Alaska, at least during while we're debating this particular. My fault.
Point taken. Community.
One of the things I think that we realized in going through this exercise is that there is a lack of real hard data from which to glean specific and, shall we say, absolutely unchallengeable conclusions. Yet we cannot wait another year to develop that data. So in the bill, we suggested rolling the reimbursement rates back to actually the 2000 schedule, and requiring a study be done that has to be delivered to the commissioner by the date is in March of 2007. And that will give us the hard data on which to make a determination as to what the proper schedule of reimbursement should be. I would hope sometime during the debate on this bill that we could actually solicit some assistance from the medical community on arriving at a rate of reimbursement that would not only slow down the escalating rates that we have in workers' comp by January 1 of 2007, but would also guarantee that injured workers had access to the best medical care possible. Because we're concerned about specialty surgeons deciding on their own that if our reimbursable rates are lower to an extent that they can't stay in business or their business isn't, their business plan isn't met, that they would withhold services, and that would be a terrible disaster for
them. That's my concern, exactly.
And it is mine as well, Representative Lynn. So somewhere in there is the answer. And someone said a long time ago that watching legislation work was like watching sausage being made. Well, we're not trying to make sausage here. We're trying to come to a conclusion and a solution that will give relief to our employers in Alaska so that people will not be laid off and businesses close because of these escalating rates.
No, I share those concerns with you. I know that I think it's quite obvious, at least I'm old enough to get Medicare, my wife is too, and I'm limited to the number of health care providers that I can go to for care because some of them just want to mess with the paperwork, and of course, you know, there are price caps on it, and I don't understand how this rollback is any different than that. I don't know what would motivate you know, healthcare providers to provide work, provide services to injured workers any more than rent control would motivate people to go out and build new apartment houses.
I understand the analogy, Mr. Chairman. Yesterday, a question we received from one of your colleagues in the other body, I think needs to be repeated here, at least the answer to it. There is a concern, first of all, the workers' compensation system is a sole remedy system.
What?
A sole remedy system. An injured worker must go through this particular system that's in statute to address their concerns and needs in terms of lost wages, retraining for a different trade or craft if they're unable to return to work, and, of course, medical assistance during the healing process. In other words, they must enter that system. My background is in maritime, where maritime cases brought for unseaworthiness claims under the Jones Act have no limitation. That an American seaman hurt on board a vessel, an unseaworthy vessel, has the right to be fully compensated for lost wages, including punitive damages. However, the workers' compensation system does not grant those rights. This is the sole remedy system. Workers cannot sue their employers for injuries on the job. They must access this system. And as so, then, injured workers must be provided the best care available to so that they can be rehabilitated and cured and returned to work if possible.
I can verify that. Many years ago, I was on the police department, and in a high-speed chase, ended up breaking my arm, and I had workers' comp. Thank heavens I was able to be covered, and I could not sue. But thank heavens I had workers' comp there to care for me, and I had three children at that time. Workers' comp came to my rescue personally.
Mr. Chairman, there are anecdotal evidence of many of us sitting in this room that have had similar experiences. I want to tell you that we cannot afford to let this system break down.
I agree.
And right now, because of the escalating rates, workers will be denied jobs. Workers will be denied access to this system eventually if we do not act this year on reforms that will make this system more cost-effective, more efficient for workers to access. And let me address the efficiency piece for now. We have, in our bill, established within the Workers' Comp Board system, a lay panel, an appeals panel, as it were, that actually mirrors the original Workers' Compensation Act that was passed in our state back in the 1960s. One panel comprised of one professional. In the beginning, it was the commissioner of the Department of Labor, and one layperson representing workers, and one person representing employers, to be the appeals or the final appeal on a controverted claim. In other words, a claim that one party or the other challenges through the process.
And who would the professional be? What?
It would be a designate of the commissioner or the director
of the administration.
Of the administration. It would be one of our professional hearing officers, I'm certain, because the body of law known as workers' compensation is a very complicated body of law with a lot of legal precedents over years of appeals before the Supreme Court of our state. So one of the issues that the carriers, the underwriters, brought to us was the issue of predictability. In other words, if you're aware that certain types of injuries, unless there's some real mitigating circumstances or additional circumstances, will be awarded at a certain level in terms of settlement, it is a lot simpler, I think, for the parties to put the sideboards around the settlement and come up with a settlement that makes sense to all parties. Without having that, however, it appears that both sides, or one side or the other, would enjoy or like to enjoy another bite at the apple to see if they can get a better decision online. And I think that's what's occurred with us with access to the Superior Court for the appeals from regular board hearings. Our bill bypasses that and uses instead an in-house super panel, as it were, an appeals panel. From there, the cases then go to the Supreme Court. But there's one thing that we've empowered the appeals panel to have that the Superior Court does not have, and that is the ability to make legal precedent on their decisions. That under the current law interpretation by our state Supreme Court, rulings by the Superior Court are not given deference by the Supreme Court, therefore make no precedent of law in workers' comp cases. Now, why is that important to injured workers, that we put this procedure in effect? Well, let me give you a couple of examples of how long it takes to get through this process. Well, simply, let me tell you this. Access to the Superior Court will push out and actually delay settlement of cases or final adjudication anywhere from 8 months to a year and a half, additional time. Yesterday, we heard testimony by actual claimants under the workers' comp system. And their complaints were, why can't I get a claim settled? Why, when the adjuster for the insurance company controverts my claim, I receive no more compensation or medical care, and my claim is going on to 3 or 4 or 5 years now without being settled? That's a common frustration that I, as commissioner, hear on a weekly basis from injured workers. And so there were two things that we concentrated on in general for our bill. One, to make the system more efficient and, frankly, more reactive to injured workers' concerns about early settlement and return to work, and also make the system more affordable for employers so that we did not have to end up trimming benefits for injured workers. Injured workers that are hurt on the job of the employer should not suffer wage losses. On the other hand, they should also not gain from it as well. And so there's a provision in the bill that has a coordination of benefits so that no worker would receive more than they would receive in a regular paycheck. And I think everyone agrees that that makes sense. But again, I didn't mean to go into great detail on the bill, Mr. Chairman. But I'll be happy to answer questions. I know the hour is late.
I'd like to ask you, if my colleagues here would like to ask any questions at this point. Representative Guttenberg?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be possible for the department to produce an organizational chart, structural chart of the new structure? Can you do that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guttenberg, of course, sir. And it would be fairly simple to do. I would think that we could produce that by probably overnight.
Another thing, is it possible to get maybe a side-by-side comparison between the governor's bill and the ad hoc bill? And
I believe that's in your packet.
Okay, and then maybe the bill that we had so much fun with last year.
Oh, I don't think you want to see that again, Mr. Chairman, but I'd be happy to do it.
I think I agree with you. Representative Crawford.
Actually, I've got lots of stuff, and I probably can wait till the next meeting. I do have one small comment. Having worked on the Oregon system, I know that's not the way that we want to go. Back in the late 90s, going down there and working in the winter when work was slack here, I burned my eardrum out. Couldn't find a surgeon there that would take my case because it was under their workers' comp rates. They said, you'd do better to go back to Alaska because anybody will take your workers' comp claims there. You can't find a surgeon here in Oregon to take your case for months and months because workers' comp pays so little. I know we don't want that. Another thing about the Oregon system, I had 20% of my hearing in my left ear, 80% of my hearing in my right ear. Add the two together, it's 50%. And they said, for your age and your occupation, 50% is fine. And that was the end of my appeals. So I know that we don't want that. I know that we've got problems. We've got to work on it. But to go to the Oregon style is no panacea for anybody.
I know that he keeps... this gentleman falls off roofs, has all these problems, so it's...
If I can comment on that, somebody does the dangerous work and that's done around here. And iron workers do a lot of it. Fishermen do a lot of it. Seafarers do a lot of it. Somebody's out there doing it. Somebody's putting their life at risk, and we need a workers' comp system that takes care of those people that do the dangerous work.
I totally agree. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. There's a part of this bill and the bill from last year, and I think when people address workers' comp, they don't deal with it. In some ways deals with the things that Representative Crawford said. When we're dealing with injured workers, get on the rolls of workers' comp. What are we doing to prevent that? What are we doing for job safety enhancements? I mean, I know many years, my previous life, there were no job safety. I mean, the job safety standards were small. Safety programs were minimal. Later years, it was, safety meetings and then go out there and forget about what we just said, get up there on that iron or get down there in that ditch. So what's the real aspect of it? How do we prevent more workers from being hurt on the job so that the roles of injured workers doesn't increase to begin with?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guttenberg, the existing rate structure, and I'm certainly willing to be corrected here, but the existing insurance rate structure does not incentivize an employer to have a good, solid safety program. And I'll tell you why it doesn't. It, even though it's experience rated in terms of the rates based on the overall pie cost, I'll give you an example of a small contractor in Ketchikan that's involved in a sawmill. Last year, their comp rate was well over $400,000, and they had less than $50,000 worth of claims. Yet the $350,000 was paid into the assigned risk pool was just paid out. There was no incentive for the level of claim that were against them. The other thing, in some of these businesses I showed you as examples, many of those businesses had zero claims. They had zero claims in history, yet they had there's no incentives in the rate to promote safety programs on the job. And that concerns me, and it certainly concerns my director of occupational health and safety. There's got to be a better way of incentivizing for employers that go the extra mile and have no accidents or less time loss accidents and have good solid safety program, but it's not built into our rate structure system as we speak.
I want to thank you for coming in today, and I think everybody in this room agrees that we have a serious problem with the workers' compensation situation. We all want to fix it for the benefit of business, for the benefit of labor, and the benefit of the economy of Alaska. And as the saying in the Good Book says, you know, come let us reason together and do what needs to be done to fix this problem. And I know we're going to be hearing, I believe, some more about workers' comp in the time to come here. And what's your next presentation going to be after this? Your next presentation before the Labor and Commerce Committee?
Mr. Chairman, I know your chairman had indicated we did not have time to take public testimony tonight, so I've used up most of the time in just touching the edges on the
right,
bill.
And I appreciate that.
But I want to offer this to you directly from the governor. Governor Frank Murkowski is the kind of a man that likes to roll up his sleeves and get down into the middle of something and come out with a solution. And this bill that you have before you is not the perfect solution to our problem. Like any other bill, it's subject to the deliberative process. And the administration is ready, willing, and able to sit down and work out a bill that meets the challenges that we've put in front of you, that we arrest these rates and still guarantee that we have a good, sound system of caring for injured workers. And I believe we need some discussion here. And I would ask this committee to consider charging all parties interested in this bill to do the same, be willing to work out a solution this session, not to delay movement of a bill for whatever reason, but to work out a solution this session. Thank you for your time.
I think we can also say that those of us in this committee, and I think for the rest of the legislature too, we're willing also to roll up our sleeves and do what needs to be done and stand up for the principles that need to be stood up for. And I want to thank you for coming in today. And sorry, we didn't have a quorum here, so we couldn't pass it out. But we could do that. Only three of us, though. Well, thank you very much. Meeting closed at 5:15.